Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to The World Transformed 2 on Fast Forward Radio. The World Transformed 2 is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find information about this series at speculist.com and worldtransformed.com. This series explores 10 major transformations that will forever change our world and our lives. Some of these transformations are likely to be upon us soon, others are already underway. Throughout this series, we're talking with futurists, scientists, philosophers, artists, pundits, and other thinkers to gain a better understanding of what we need to do to prepare ourselves for these changes and for life in a world transformed. In The World Transformed 2, we're exploring how we think, life extension, nanotechnology, human enhancement, artificial general intelligence, virtual worlds, post-scarcity, existential risks, the technological singularity, and finally, human destiny. Tonight, we present part 8 in the series, Our Fears Transformed. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Excellent, excellent. I'm really excited about the program tonight. You know, seems like there's a lot that you could be afraid of these days. And, I think we got some things to talk about tonight.
There's a lot of fear in the air. There's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of fear. Well, you know, we talked, I think last time we did The World Transformed, about Pareto analysis, that really we should be focusing at least 80-20 on positive futures to negative futures. With us being the big optimists, we're obviously going to be 80% on the positive. But out of 10 shows, we're only doing 1 out of 10 that's on existential risk. But in fairness, we've spent every single one of these shows leading up to this talking not only about the benefits but the potential risks and downsides of all of the transformations that we've explored. So I think we've been pretty good about looking at existential risks as they crop up topically, but tonight that's going to be our main subject. So let's jump into it. It's both exciting and daunting to live in an age possessed of so much possibility, as demonstrated by the wide array of topics discussed in this series. It's exciting because our awareness of possibility is so much greater than it was even a generation or two ago, and it's daunting for exactly the same reason. We can envision plausible triumphs for humanity that really do transcend our wildest dreams, or at least our most glorious fantasies, as articulated a few decades ago. Likewise, we can envision bleak and dangerous scenarios, including the worst of all possible outcomes, the sudden and utter disappearance of our civilization, or of our species, or of life itself. Such a fate now presents itself as the end result of not just one possible calamity, but of many. So to talk about this, we've assembled a panel of futurists to help us navigate these rather treacherous waters and help us understand what the risks are, why we should be thinking about them, and what we should be doing about them. So let's introduce them now.
Brian Wong is a longtime futurist and writer of some 8,000 articles on nextbigfuture.com. Next Big Future, one of my favorite sites, is a top 5 science website per Technorati and has over 1 million page views per month. Brian has studied extinction risk and all the current major causes of death and damage and how to mitigate them. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Next, we've got our friend Michael Anisimov. In 2005, at age 21, Michael Anisimov co-created the concept for the Singularity Summit, the world's largest conference focused on transhumanist technologies. Under his tenure as media director at the Singularity Institute, the organization was covered by GQ, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, Playboy, The New York Times, Scientific American, NPR, Forbes, and a front-page article in Time magazine. Michael's personal blog, Accelerating Future, another big favorite of ours, is among the most popular transhumanist blogs with over 100,000 monthly unique visitors. Michael, great to have you with us.
Hey, Phil.
We've also got with us tonight social futurist, writer, and stealth group casting startup CEO Alvis Bridges. It focuses on the social aspects of convergent accelerating information, technology, communication, and capability growth. Welcome, Alvis.
Hey, guys. Great to be here, as always.
Well, it's great to have you with us, Alvis. Michael and Brian, a terrific panel that we've assembled this evening, and we're going to be talking about risks that humanity faces. Now, in the outline to the World Transform 2, we've made it clear that our focus this time around, as distinct from the first time we did the World Transform, is we're not necessarily defining all of these risks in technical terms. So we're going to talk about the impact and why people need to be concerned about these things, and to the extent that we can, what people should be doing as individuals about these things, and what people should be doing at a societal level. So I want to start with a very basic question. And I think, Michael, we'll give this one to you to begin. And here's the question. Why would the average person concern him or herself with the thought of existential risk? I mean, aren't there some risks, for example, cosmic radiation burst from an exploding star, that we can't possibly do anything about, and so we shouldn't worry about at all? And if so, you know, where do we draw the line on things that we effectively can do something about and can't?
All right, Phil. Let's see. Well, I think, like, to a certain extent, your own self and your own life should come first before you start worrying about, like, global issues. Because if you don't, like, fix your own situation and you're not happy with where you are, then you don't have, like, attention or effort to spend on where the human race is going in the future. But if you do feel like you are doing well in your career and whatnot, you want to add more to humanity beyond the typical, like, American dream, I guess you could say, or whatever it is that keeps you satisfied, well, then you might turn to, like, charity and give money to Amnesty International, or you might volunteer time, like, at a soup kitchen or something like that. But for some of us, we, while those other, like, objectives and activities can be helpful, we want to impact humanity beneficially in the long-term future. And if you study history a lot, you see that every 50 to 100 to 150 or whatever years, there's a bunch of catastrophes which occur. And because of the financial meltdown that's happened in the last decade, we've seen that can happen to us. And as we saw in, like, the last week, the stock market fell again. So people do discuss the, like, more wide issues sometimes, like in the news and that kind of thing. But I think the greatest risks are the ones that we're going to have to deal with before we get to the stage of being able to colonize other planets. And because once we are able to colonize other planets, then we will be safer than we were before. But until that point, I think it will get more and more dangerous, because we get greater tools and our intelligence doesn't increase. So we're just the same old humans with more and more powerful tools. So, like, if you care about global warming, I think that you should also care about other global risks, like nuclear war and the whole raft of them, bioterror, et cetera.
Now, just to be very clear, what's the difference that our moving into space makes for purposes of protecting us from risk? Why is that an important move?
Oh, because then there might be a lot more of us, and we'd be spread out over a much larger area, so we'd be more redundant, and civilization itself would just be safer that way. And I think that we can do that with redundancy now by like colonizing more areas of Earth and developing like ways of living that are more resilient. What the future is, John Roggs has a concept of what he calls resilient communities that would be more economically and physically resilient in comparison to today's communities, which are often based on very fragile networks.
Absolutely. Spread us out a little bit. And what happens there is that we talk about saving the planet as being equivalent to, congruent with, saving humanity, but ultimately there could come a time when humanity is spread out, Earth is destroyed, and humanity goes on. I mean, that's, you know, the we don't want that to happen, but that's sort of what you're implying there. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, after about 1 billion years, the sun will expand to the point where it'll start frying everything on Earth. So 1 billion years is a very long time, but I think that also, like, our fate is tied to the fate of the rest of the planet. We have the ability to screw over every other species on the planet and the whole ecosystem if we mess up. So it's not just ourselves that we have responsibility for. But if we succeed, then we can spread all the denizens of the planet into other places and multiply their complexity and have, like, a more beneficial trajectory. And so it's not just us, but we're a big part of it, too.
Absolutely. Okay, so same question over to you, Alvis. Why should the average person worry about existential risk?
Well, I like a lot of what the bulk of what Michael just had to say. I mean, I think there are people who are role players in given areas, in different economic roles, and certainly when it comes to thinking about existential risk, there's probably our economics on Earth probably allows a certain amount of people to specialize enough in order to even consider that topic. The folks who aren't all into that, they're out there, being the best humans they can be, and that's probably for the best in a big positive sum system, which is, sure appears that we're in. That said, it does appear that we're increasing our ability through accelerating change, as Michael is saying, which leads to an expanded awareness of existential risk. Our imagination, our collective capacity to imagine, is growing, as a square to this technological acceleration. And then my one peccadillo, with what you said, Mike, earlier, is that I don't think we're necessarily just the same old humans with better tools. The way my view of acceleration and society, my view of acceleration in society is that the two coexist and auto-catalytically evolve together, so that as we move forward, we are expanding ourselves through Google, through these tools, but that we're also starting to see changes in the brain, in social behavior, and even in some genetic evolution just around certain brain areas over the last 10,000 years, language capacity and things like that, that we may in fact be transforming, and the nature of ourselves is this type of transformation, which kind of changes the bigger context for, can we truly wink out of existence? What are we? What is society? What's the bigger context for humanity, for our communities? If life is redundant throughout the universe, as it could be, then maybe existential risk is kind of, mitigated, because, if we wink out over here, we're still over there, because we're part of this bigger, longer process.
When you say if life is spread throughout the universe, you're talking about us spreading out, right? You're not saying life is already there.
Well, I'm saying if life is already there,
right?
If the universe has the capacity to generate life like us, that's a possibility. And another possibility is that the universe, very deliberately has seeded life like us all over the place, through some sort of, process, in a simulation, for some reason or another, then all of a sudden, our context for, going out of existence changes. So it's very difficult to prove all that stuff, these are philosophical arguments, but there's always that possibility.
It would be an interesting topic to get into. I know Michael is quite skeptical on the idea of whether there's life elsewhere in the universe, and we won't get into it tonight. But definitely the idea is true, whether it's already there or whether we become the life that's there. That redundancy provides a mitigation of the idea of existential risk that nothing else does. I want to come back to something you said in just a moment, but before we do, Brian, same question to you. Why would the average person concern him or herself with existential risk?
Yes, there are certain risks which we can't do anything about, but there are several which we can. There's the large asteroid, which wiped out the dinosaurs, which those kind of things are still out there. And so if we have some planning, some capability to make better telescopes, detect them, get some space capability to deflect them, then we can protect ourselves from it. And it's better for those kind of situations not to have insurance of money or trying to recover financially, because it wipes you all out. You have to prevent them. The only way to do anything about it is not to recover, because there is no recovery from total annihilation. You have to prevent them.
Okay, so Stephen, before we go on to, I know you've got a question you're ready to ask, but something Alvis you just said brought out a question that I was formulating earlier, and I think now might be the right time to ask it. I talked a little bit about that Pareto principle earlier, that we focus 80% on positive outcomes and 20% on negative outcomes. And one of the reasons that I think that that mix is actually correct, we talk at The Speculist about something called the human imperative, is that it seems to me that we increase our capability substantially to do so many things when we focus on developing nanotechnology, when we talk about moving to post-scarcity. Alvis, when we talk about doing a lot of the things that that you were just talking about. So I want to put it to the panel. Is it correct for us to focus on existential risks separately and apart from these other transformations that are occurring? Or should we be looking at developing artificial intelligence, developing nanotechnology, working towards all of these outcomes with an eye to preventing those kinds of risks? And Alvis, since you inspired that question, I'll start that one with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think we're in a situation where you can't put the genie back in the bottle. You know, life moves in one direction, and we're forced. We're in an environment in which agents are competing against one another in order to develop as quickly as possible, and we also have no idea what sort of competition or other forces outside of our system could wink us at. So I think, not knowing that, I think the only logical course of action is for our system to continue propelling itself forward as fast as possible. You know, and I think that along the way, that acceleration, I was saying before, expands our imagination so widely, so that, you know, the 80% positive that we can be working on is dramatically expanded in terms of orders of magnitude even. And then the 20% awareness of risks and eye toward that sort of thing is also expanded. You know, so I think we'd better be getting better at both.
Interesting. Okay, so our capability of preventing risk grows, but the risks themselves grow along with the new capabilities. Michael, same question over to you.
I think, like, the human tendency is to focus on the good and ignore the risks and the bad because it's funner and more psychologically pleasing and more socially acceptable. So while, like, many people, I think, might benefit from the 80-20 thing, and I probably would tend towards that even myself, I think that those that are willing to spend even more of their effort and time on that 20% of risk could be doing humanity a great service because they are doing the dirty job that other people don't want to do.
Mm, yeah. Well, and you got to do the 20. The thing is, if you divide it up 80-20, you still have to do that 20. And to me, it seems that it's better to have the 80-20 than 99-1, right? Which is kind of how people tend to want to focus on it. Brian, what do you think? Do we mitigate risk by becoming more capable, and so focus more on developing our capabilities, or should we focus more on the risks and preventing the bad things from happening?
I think that there's the realistic aspect of it, that most people don't get the existential risks. You know, they just don't understand it. You know, they have bad risk understanding anyway. You know, pretty much basic life insurance is about the capacity of, like, you know, maybe 60% of people, 40% of people don't even get basic life insurance. They just don't understand it or just don't appreciate it. So in terms of getting people to accept and want to do something about it, it's kind of like we already have these known risks that have hit, you know, like the big financial things that hit, Enron that hit, and then the response after the fact, after you already knew it happened, just happened to you, you couldn't pass something that would actually fix it. You know, the Sarbanes-Oxley was the response to it, and Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't actually prevent Enron's. All it does is it makes it easy to prosecute people who do it, you know, a little bit, you know, and even that not that well. So I think that the good thing about mitigation, and I discuss that a fair bit, is that that if we get stronger, like if we do a bunch of things like preventing 40 million out of 55 million people from dying by improving public health and infrastructure and several easy things, then we will be better off than if we were not in that situation. If we were, you know, healthy and not sick, we're better able to take a disease or some other kind of thing hitting you. It doesn't help against the really big risks like big asteroids, super AI, those things which just being a little healthier just doesn't do squat, right? You're still going to be facing that thing that if you hadn't planned 20 years ahead of time or done other preparation things, you're still not going to be able to survive them. But so that would, so I guess that it, mitigation helps, getting stronger helps in certain situations. Other ones which we're not addressing, it doesn't help, and you're still screwed that way, but at least you're less screwed on the other 99. And if you're not going to act on the 1% anyway, then you're still, you know, so that...
And in order to mitigate, you, obviously you've got to be aware of them and be thinking about them. So it sounds like it's kind of a forewarned is forearmed sort of approach.
Right, and people can be forewarned, but just right now, and they have been forewarned now, but they're ignoring it, they laugh it off, they just don't believe it, and that's the problem, is that many people just refuse to believe or accept even very, you know, I think, well, risks, and they just say, I don't want to act upon that. We decided collectively that that should be laughed at, and so we're going with that, and then you just don't respond to it.
Yeah. Well, so once again, if it's 80-20, you definitely have to do the you have to do the 20. Okay, Stephen, what's our next question?
Well, I wanted to ask, and I guess I'll start with you, Michael. You know, of the risks that are out there, the existential risks particularly. Which should we be more concerned about, man-made risks, you know, or natural risk? I mean, is the EMP that wipes us out coming from a solar flare or a high-altitude nuke? What do you think, Michael?
So to answer your question, I think that we're pretty well covered on the natural side of things because we've been around through the last 200,000 years without being wiped out, so that's pretty good evidence that we can last another 200,000 if we were just facing natural issues. I don't think that anything natural could wipe out all of humanity. If there were an EMP or a solar flare, which is certainly a possibility, maybe it would wipe out our electric grid and maybe it could cause many millions of deaths even due to infrastructure collapse or something like that. But over a historical time period, over a historically relevant time period, we'd bounce back. So the fact that we've lived this long, to me, shows that the natural is not a big deal and that we mainly have to worry about the man-made. And especially, like, if you look at history and man's capacity for evil, I'm more concerned about human actors. And humans are just more effective than nature. We can operate on much faster timescales. So I see human-created problems as the issue. And I still think that today the number one existential risk or major risk is plain old nuclear warfare. So I like to point to that as like the staple that still hangs over our heads. And that's why I love when Obama and Kissinger and people like that come together and say, let's work towards a planet with zero nukes, because they're taking that step forward of saying, like, even if the risk is 1% per year, eventually you're going to lose that game over enough years. So they see that there's a risk to be mitigated there, and they're working towards it. So I really admire that kind of stuff.
Alvis, what do you think? Natural or man-made?
I think the natural is just like this, you know, probability that's in the background. It's kind of always been there. You know, will our sun die somehow? Will something come flying through and just blast us? You know, and I agree with Michael that it's unlikely that something will take out all of humanity. And we certainly have been around long enough. And life on Earth has existed for billions of years and has proven to be very resilient for some reason or another. And the reasons for that are, you know, definitely up for debate. There might be like life seeding or like kind of, there might be something in the code that allows that to happen. You know, that said, I think we're getting better at analyzing natural risks. You know, once again, as a square of acceleration, I think our imagination of those grows. going to the human side, I think we have really big reason to be concerned or to develop a simulation of what is going on with accelerating change. Because as Michael said, humans can be nasty. Humans are competing agents. Biological systems compete against one another. And, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, as we accelerate into the future, you know, how hard the takeoff is going to be, whether that requires creative destruction, whether that requires several compressed cycles of creative destruction. I think that we know something's coming, and it's coming really soon, so we should be very focused on that.
All right. All right. Brian, what do you think, natural or man-made?
Probably man-made, but let me address the nuclear war issue. That's one I've studied a fair bit. Our current arsenal is not enough to kill every person. The current nukes that the United States and Russia have aren't enough to kill everyone. You would kill a lot, you know, if you were really actively trying to say, you know, I'm going to use this arsenal and try and kill everyone, then you could get, you know, into the billions of people dead, but you're not going to kill everyone. And the realistic scenario where you're looking at U.S. nukes and Russian nukes, one, I think it's not going to happen that the U.S. and Russia are going to have the all-out nuclear war, that there's no reason, you know, there's nothing in the, you know, current situation that indicates that that's on the table at all. So, and if you did have that on the table, you'd have a first-strike situation where the U.S. or Russia would hit first and attack the other's nukes as opposed to the people. So then, again, you'd even have far lower death count than that. And I think that, so there is other advancing technology, not here right now, not none of our current technology per se, well, maybe a biological thing or something like that, but none of our current technology off the shelf as of right now is going to do it. You need to have something where you push it farther in order to achieve actual, to kill all 7 billion people and talk about it. You can do a multiple thing where you have nuclear war or have some other conventional war, take out medical and other stuff, and then on top of that do something else and start shoving things over the edge. But it wouldn't be just one go. It would be, you have to really work at it. And I just, so you know, when we have more technology, more other stuff, then yes, you could have a situation where the technology could do it. But the other thing is that technology advancing means we can make ourselves tougher, and it goes to the mitigation thing. We could build tougher buildings, simple things like better turquoise nails in buildings to make them more resilient, blast-proofing wallpaper and various other things. There's various things you can do to make it so that the blast radius that could destroy the building would get less and less, and if the building stands up, the people can more easily survive. So I'm for more serious, active, reinvented civil defense to make us tougher against these kind of known risks. The other thing is that with really advanced technology coming along, that I think space technology is coming, and then you can spread out. If you spread out among the solar system, which, you know, I've worked out various paths for doing that in a relatively, you know, few decades, then with the speed of light and all that kind of stuff, you've made it so that it's virtually impossible to kill that civilization. If you have nuclear fusion, space capability, net technology, I can't think of the technology that would take that out, you know, other than an enemy technology, enemy civilization, enemy AI having the same level of stuff actually fighting and killing the other side.
All right. So here's what we're going to do in this next part of the program. We're going to work through a checklist of potential existential risks. This is hardly an exhaustive list, but it's the one. It's Stephen's and my favorites. Okay, these are the ones that first came to mind. And here's what I'd like the panel to do. I'd like each of you to address this risk from a standpoint of, is this one that would wipe us out altogether, potentially, or one that would just slow us down, potentially. That's the first thing we want to know about it. Then how likely do you think it is? And then finally, what ought we to be doing about it? And I think a good one to start with would actually be nuclear and or conventional warfare, which we've addressed to a certain extent. I think Brian has given his answer to that one. And so I'll pass that on to the others. But before I do, I'll just say don't talk about bio-warfare because that one's going to come up later in the list. So, Michael, you want to give us you introduced the topic of nuclear warfare, but can you tell us your thoughts on the likelihood of it and whether it would be a true existential risk for civilization or whether it's something that would slow us down?
I think I agree with Brian that the current like geopolitical situation, all the big boys understand that they bring down everything if they attack one another. So that interdependence of the global economy and improvements in international relations since the Cold War has made me more optimistic. So I don't think that's too likely to happen, and it wouldn't be an existential risk. It would just kill maybe, in a worst-case scenario, like 500 million. So it's definitely something we could bounce back from. But I just like it as a starting point to thinking about the topic in general because it's still I'd say the probability yearly is maybe less, around 1%, like not much more, not much less. And I think there's also the possibility of accidental nuclear launches that cause limited exchanges, but not a full risk to humanity in general.
Okay, Alvis, same question to you.
Yeah, I generally, you know, come down on it on this one the same way. I think that conventional nuclear warfare, as we envision it right now, would have a very low chance of wiping out every single human, and that humans would bounce back, and certainly life on Earth would bounce back. You know, that said, I do envision a scenario, you know, this classic Skynet scenario where the enemy might come from within. You know, we may develop AI in-house that mutates by itself and, you know, has its own rules. You know, this is where we get into, like, creating friendly AI or not. An unfriendly AI combined with nuclear weapons could result in a nuclear holocaust that deliberately wipes out humanity. I think it's incredibly low probability, but there's that one scenario.
That could happen. What about this possibility? What about a we just had our post-scarcity show last week, and what if you combine nuclear capability with a hacker/maker/ post-scarcity world where lots and lots of people are building bombs? Could you potentially have a scenario where it's not just one or two major superpowers hurling nukes at each other, but it's dozens or hundreds of smaller entities or even just individuals throwing nukes at each other? And does, you know, how would that change the assessment of the whole thing if something like that were to occur? Brian, do you think something like that would be possible? And if so, does the potential damage of nuclear war become greater?
Yeah, I could see a situation where nuclear-like capability could get to smaller groups and to individuals over the course of you know, a few decades, if we get molecular nanotechnology and could filter the do your own enrichment, or if you had superconductors and could put them in orbit and get your own antimatter, that that kind of capability could get into the hands of a few people, and that would change the equation because they could cause a lot of death. And I'm not sure if they would be able to get and cure everyone, because if you have that level of technology with everyone, you'd be foolish not to use it to defend yourself. There's
right.
A lot of things that you become more powerful. You can, again, that spread out situation, that you get spread out across the solar system, and then they can't do it. If you were stupid enough as a civilization to have that kind of capability and stay on planet Earth, yeah, then you're screwed, because you're basically living in a phone booth or in a basement and saying, oh, let's all have hand grenades. It's like, well, you're in a basement. Yeah, you can kill everyone. If you kind of spread out, you're okay.
Still not a great idea, but, yeah, it's better than doing it in the basement, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Others on the panel, what do you think of my twist on the nuclear war scenario? Is Michael, you gave us the 500 million would be killed. It seems to me that this could potentially lead to the deaths of billions, but would you still maintain that it's not a it's not an absolute end game, that it would still be a survivable potential set of risks.
Yeah, I think it would still be survivable, but yet worse. I'm also concerned about the possibility of like fabricating really small robots that people could use to kill their enemies. But in the end, like humans aren't that murderous, even if there weren't any repercussions. Even if there were a massive war, people would get tired of killing eventually, and you need to like kill everyone on the planet, then kill yourself to really wipe out everyone. And I don't really see that happening. So I'm more concerned about the risks from like either new transhuman species or AI that really has it out for humanity and actually wants to wipe us all out, but I am skeptical that we'd truly wipe ourselves out completely, even in that scenario, although it would increase the risk.
Okay, well, we'll get to those other risks as we work our way down the list. Alvis, any other thoughts on that one? My everybody gets a nuke scenario. Does that change your thoughts on the riskiness of nuclear war?
It adds unpredictability to the equation. You know, I totally agree with the panel that you know, as we move forward in time, you know, our offensive capabilities increase, and so do our defensive capabilities. There seems to be like this developmental immunity that's like kind of contained in like the law of like competing/cooperating agents, and it looks like you know, humanity on Earth certainly is on a positive sum trajectory. Now, so it seems like this kind of protectionism in systems seems to be built in. Systems seem to be, you know, the systems that propagate, you know, may have learned this from iterations, you know, in early in our biology or, you know, or even earlier than that. So, you know, from that standpoint, I think that's mitigated. You know, that said, as we accelerate into the future, you know, is there one moment where our capacity to destroy so exceeds our capacity to react and defend that we just, you know, trip up and slip up and wink out. You know, that's a possibility, you know, rooted in like stuff we can't even really imagine right now.
Okay. Scary stuff. All right. Stephen, what's next on our list of possible risks here?
Well, here's a fun one. Gray goo. You know, any kind of, you know, I've heard green goo, you know, if that was some sort of, you know, taking over some sort of biological system where it replicates over and over. But your choice of color as far as the goo goes, but what do you think, Brian?
Well, gray goo was analyzed quite well by Robert Freitas in a paper that he wrote a few years back. But basically, and gray goo being molecular nanotechnology, little robots that reproduce and chew everything up and then destroy everything. So his analysis of that was that because the nanobots still have to have physical action, you'd be able to detect the heat that they generated as they were replicating out and do this consumption thing, that if you had your satellites looking, that you could detect that this was happening. Or if it was going slow enough where the temperature wasn't happening, then again, you should be able to have your sensors and spot that this is going on and then react with your counter nanotechnology or hit it with other weapons and then stop it. So that for that is the analysis that I think applies to that one, that you should be able to react to that one.
Okay. Michael, what do you think?
Brian said it. I concur with Brian. Robert Freitas has actually like run the numbers and studied this really extensively. And like a short article that listeners might look at is gray goo is a small or gray goo is not a big issue. I think it's called, or gray goo is a small issue. It's an article written by Eric Drexler and Chris Phoenix that argues that molecular nanotech arms races are a much bigger deal than autonomous replicators.
Okay. How about you, Alvis?
I think it's like one of these classic scenarios where we like reach into the future, grab technology and like pull it back to the past. And that to, you know, truly examine it, definitely like Freitas has done, and maybe even more extensively, like maybe it should be looked at from a more like how do we get to the gray goo standpoint. I think looking at it from like a systems like and learning perspective, gray goo will have to be somewhat smart. You know, and it will have to be encoded with somewhat, you know, with intelligence. At the same time, the whole environment will have more intelligence in it, and our resilience and our, you know, our immunities to this kind of stuff along the way will grow. So the question is, does it at one point spiral out of control? Like right now, if Grey Goo was unleashed, we wouldn't be ready for it. But when Grey Goo would even be possible, when it could even possibly exist, say 15, 20, 25 years out in the future, we got to definitely simulate that we ourselves will be significantly more intelligent and smarter. So I think, I think it's one of those classic kind of like, ratios that the system will get smarter and just hopefully it won't get so far ahead of us that we can't react fast enough.
That brings a different question to mind to me, which is just one of if we posited Grey Goo back at a time when we had kind of a vague idea of what this is all about, are there unexpected or less expected potential nanotechnology disasters that could occur that aren't Grey Goo, but that might possibly follow something of a similar trajectory of things spinning out of control? Are there other possible nanotech disasters that have been kind of overlooked because Grey Goo has been so effectively dealt with as kind of a solved problem? Alvis, do you think there are other things we should be worrying about around nanotechnology?
Yeah, I think when you get greater intelligence, right, and you finally get this hybridization of the digital to the biological, like imagine if you get an AI at some point that just starts, that gets biology and can actually maybe instead of using nanotechnology to manufacture more stuff that looks like hard technology to us, what if it is more intelligent and it hijacks biology and starts, concertedly using biology against us just because it went haywire or those are the rules of the system or for whatever reason? I think it could be cleverer than Grey Goo. I think Grey Goo is just it's a lowest common denominator scenario that everyone can sink their teeth into.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I was going to say, rather than passing that possibility on to the others, because that starts to talk about the dangers of artificial intelligence, I believe, and that's actually my next item on the list. So let's go ahead and talk about that one. Unfriendly AI or any other kind of singularity disaster, end of the world scenarios resulting from the emergence of greater than human intelligence. Michael, obviously I want to start with you on this one since we've talked about this one numerous times in the past. Tell us what you think the probabilities are around that and whether you see that as a thing that slows us down or a thing that draws us completely to a stop and what we ought to be doing about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've devoted most of my adult life and career to mitigating that one risk since I think that's the number one risk ahead of us. And I actually think most of the others are pretty small by comparison. So, I think, in fact, the risk is quite great that we won't handle the transition to superintelligence correctly. And the key thing here is how smart are humans in the scheme of all possible intelligences, and how more powerful is an intelligence that is more intelligent than us? And when you look at AI and all its capabilities, AIs could think really quickly if they could think at all, because they run on a substrate that just operates so much more quickly than biological neurons do. So if you had an AI that can think maybe 1,000, 10,000, or 100,000 times faster than human beings, could copy itself, share knowledge, search out new areas of concept space more effectively than human beings, I think that would be a massive risk right there. So see, the crucial challenge of the future is transmitting some kind of value system into AI such that humanity today isn't wiped out. And I think that by default you lose in that scenario because it's so difficult rather than win, because human morality and values, even though it's so intuitive to us, it wouldn't necessarily be intuitive to an arbitrary intelligence. So making that transfer I see is extremely difficult and a subject that should be given great study by specialists.
And can you make a even rough ballpark estimate of what you think the probabilities are on that occurring? Can we mitigate those probabilities, I guess?
I mean, I think that it's at least 50-50 that we will be wiped out and replaced by a different kind of intelligence that just doesn't particularly value us, if not greater. And what can we do about it? I think that we can work to deliberately engineer that creation of the first superintelligence or superintelligences to have like some kind of connection with them where they see us as being valuable rather than valueless. And I think that if you look at nature, all species are pretty much out for themselves. The altruism, if it exists at all, generally is limited to within the family. So the default of nature is selfishness, not altruism. And even though humans like to be as altruistic as possible, especially like talking about altruism, giving lip service to it, if you see the way humans have behaved throughout history and today, that most agents are selfish. That's how we came into existence. And because we evolved and when push comes to shove, we're pretty self-protective, and that's just the way that Darwinian organisms are built. And I think that's how a way that a lot of organisms will tend to be.
Well, it's kind of hard to argue against billions of years of evolution. That's for sure. Although I will say, in defense of humanity, we are the only species that I know of that ever even talks about other species. You know, that ever thinks about the welfare of other species. So hopefully, we can pass some of that concern on to onto that next substrate. Okay. Brian, same question to you. What's your assessment of the risk of unfriendly artificial intelligence?
I think it definitely is increasing. We have, you know, Moore's Law, and I think that there is new capabilities that are clearly being funded and developed with neuromorphic chips, being able to make memory registers into synapses, possibly the trillions of scales, even within this decade. So we'll have, you know, by the end of 2020, exaflop supercomputers and a lot of, you know, near human scale, a whole brain emulation, getting close to that. Probably won't have a lot of the software, though, you know, there's always a possibility of breakthrough there, but just on pure raw power, it's coming up there. So by 2030, getting zettaflops and including having the computational capability for that to happen. So, and I don't see that ending there. I think there will be continued improvement beyond that. So then it becomes more and more likely and becomes a certainty that you'll be able to get some kind of intelligence beyond our current human level within a few decades. And then what happens when that happens and the various scenarios. I think that the greater than human intelligence and greater than all the humanity's intelligence type systems, that a more likely scenario is that if you get that kind of capability, any kind of like super AI or like that technology, that you or the AI would use that capabilities and develop all the other like capability with nuclear fusion, with any of it that wasn't already here, that we kind of know and are working towards, that you can use one of them to then leverage yourself and get the other capabilities. And that you could scoop up all those known, maybe we should be able to get this if we just figured out a few more tricks, that you could use one to help you get to the others. So then you would get the whole suite of capabilities in like nanotechnology, space, fusion, the whole thing, and then I would distance anyone who didn't have that set. So then,
But you're presupposing that, to Michael's point earlier, you're presupposing that the artificial intelligence is interested in helping us do things, right? I mean, if it's...
No, I'm thinking that they would get it for themselves. Even if they weren't going to share it with us, that they would get it for themselves. So they would say,
okay.
You know... Okay. You're just like, if you have the D-Day invasion, you know, Saving Private Ryan, you had the thing where they hit the beaches and then they start gathering, going, go gather other weapons and other stuff, right? You would gather capability first before you launched an attack, right? You would get yourself as strong as you can be, and you could get molecular nanotechnology fusion. You wouldn't, like, launch a preemptive thing because, one, people wouldn't even know you're around, so why would you, like, be that, you know, quick to say, okay, now I want to wipe them out. You know, I mean, I just started and I just became aware I'm not going to start wiping them out. It's like, no hurry. I'm still getting stronger far faster than they are, and
right,
so I should
right.
I'm following you now. Okay, so what do we do? How do we, what's the potential mitigation to that?
Well, we need to work on the breakthroughs and get all those capabilities for ourselves. Like, a lot of these things, I think there are many projects that could help us get that kind of capability sooner, so we should do that. So then, might be in a better situation. And the other thing would be, we should do what Michael suggests of working toward the mathematically provable friendly system. Like, even if that turns out to be partially unnecessary, just like the Y2K thing, better safe than sorry. Like, the bad scenario is so bad, why not work on doing it? Unfortunately, right now, the realistic scenario is that there's only going to be a few hundred, a few thousand people working towards that goal, because no one else believes in it. But
right, okay, all right. So, Alvis, let's push this one over to you. What do you take? Anything to add to what you've heard from the other two?
Yeah, I think so. As always, I like to take one step back and say, how do we, what's the bigger context? Like, how are we likely to get to strong AI? And it sure looks like it's through, a lot of human agents working on it together, mining information from our world and from our own brains and building a lot of this stuff, in the image of the biology and of the brains around us. During that process, does that end up feeling like an extension of us, just like Google feels like an extension of us? Is the path to strong AI really, collective, widespread intelligence amplification? The way that things are going right now in AI development, it certainly seems that way to me. If we do look at AI as an extension of our human system and our body, or even, more broadly, our biological system, then if that happens and that occurs, and then is that us? And if that is us, then we're not at risk. Transcension hypothesis is accurate, and a lot of people have ventured. If that's still us, if that our pattern remains in there and it feels like us, then we're not at risk. But then again, if we do get to a strong AI that is not us, then I think we need to be rather worried. And at that point, in order to mitigate the risk there, we need to hope that we'll be in a positive sum dynamic with this thing, or in some other relationship that encourages this superintelligence to, allow us to exist. Maybe in that scenario we'll end up like cattle, like in the Matrix.
Right.
Or we'll, we may be more or less like having a an adult conversation, symbiotically, but still kind of being distinct. So I think for me, this one really comes down to how, is the AI that we're going to create an extension of us, or is it a discrete unit? And I think that's very open to debate.
Okay, well, I'm going to swing that particular question back to you, Michael. Would you agree that if the AI considers itself to be us, then the major problem is solved, that such an entity is not going to treat us the way we treat bacteria in a swimming pool? And if that's the case, then you're saying that it's at least a 50-50 shot that that it won't think it's us. Is that correct?
I mean, the way that I see, I think like the idea of thinks it's us is kind of not that well defined. But I mean, even if I give it a charitable definition, this is something new. It's something different. Artificial intelligence. I think that if we were aliens looking at ourselves, we'd see how specific and distinct we are. And I don't see the essence of humanity per se is something that we can pass on to a system whose brain computes a million times more sensory information and concepts than us. To say it's like us, it would have to be different but nice to us, the way that I see it, to increase the probability of success. I mean, maybe one way of making an AI more like us would be to upload human beings and have that be the first superintelligence and have an uploaded human entity kind of shepherd the creation of artificial intelligence from then on. And I would think, I actually have started to lean towards preferring that scenario if it were possible. I don't think the way the technologies look to me, it varies depending on who you are and what, you know, what your beliefs on the matter are, but it looks to me like that artificial general intelligence would be easier to achieve than uploaded human beings. So I see the alienness, the path that we have to program AI from scratch ourselves, I see as pretty hard to avoid. And then would we want to make like a copy of ourselves? No. So then the question is, what features would we need to give it that sense of being, feeling like a part of the human family, or maybe a part of like the family of Earth-deriving minds? I think that maybe that actually becomes equivalent to the question of friendly AI in general, which is what I was talking about earlier. So I'd be interested in like really drilling down and saying like which features would we need to implement in AI to give it that connection to us.
Okay, so it's still a major problem around whether the AI identifies itself as being part of humanity or as being an extension of humanity, or whether we give it that ability to at least empathize with us. All right, so Stephen, what's next on the list?
Well, what about an engineered disease? Alvis, what do you think?
You know, I am not a biologist and nor a doctor. So, like, you know, when it comes down to the math and looking at that stuff right now, you know, I'm not qualified. But as I mentioned before, I think that something biological in tandem with a super intelligent virus or an AI that is deliberately controlling it, you know, I think when you, like, that's a big risk to humanity. I think it's big enough to be considered an existential risk. I think the notion of looking into the future 10, 15, 20 years and imagining a world in which the digital and the biological have been hybridized more, there's much more understanding of the biological. If that's controlled, you know, by nefarious agents or even by kind of smart but dumb agents, software agents at some level, that they could wreak enormous havoc on us. You know, that said, it will all obviously be mitigated by the understanding, the collective understanding that we all share, and, you know, the realization that that is occurring, you know, as it confronts us. So if I had to put that, you know, like a chance on it, I would say, or percentage on it, I'd say I'd give it a 1.5% chance of wiping us out.
All right.
But that's still, you know,
like that. Yeah.
Concerning enough to deal with.
Yeah, you still don't want to mess with that, do you?
All right. Okay. Well, what do you think, Brian? An engineered disease, what are the risks that wipes us out? And, is it something that we need to be concerned with?
I think it's definitely something to be concerned about. If not wipe us out, to cause a lot more damage. Disease already kills tens of millions every year, so getting something that's more dangerous would obviously be very, very bad. There is work to try and combat disease. You know, Gates Foundation and various other UN organizations and countries working towards vaccination programs and other things. That goes towards creating better public health and other mitigations that way. One interesting thing that's recently happened, or is happening, is MIT is working on a general antiviral system where basically I think it's some kind of RNA-based approach where they can detect a cell that's been infected by a virus and be able to kill that cell. So then it stops the virus. So then if you had that thing fully developed and had good detection for early detection that you're being followed by virus, then you could do something to make yourself immune to virus attack. So there are approaches and technological ways to to make us far more resilient against that kind of thing. On the other hand, there's a new George Church and I think other people at Harvard and some other universities there have a system for super accelerated evolution and broad scale genetic engineering, where they can engineer 1,000 different gene changes as opposed to before when you'd have to work to make a few. So the acceleration around being able to cook up something completely new and fast and different and very bad seems to be going somewhat faster than the systems that we can defend ourselves with. So that means that the risks are going to be higher for a while until we get to the defense. So I think offense is going to lead defense for a few decades.
Okay.
And that's kind of our window of vulnerability. Yeah.
Well, Michael, what do you think?
I'm pretty concerned about the bio stuff in the next 10 to 20 to 30 year time frame. I am encouraged by the work that's being done on general antiviral drugs, and I think one of the cool things about progress is that we do eventually solve problems and solve risks definitively. Like the challenge of getting around the world was not completely solved, but we did it one a much further way towards solving it with the invention of a gasoline engine. So now you can hop in a car or take a train or a plane or something like that somewhere. So that problem was solved. And penicillin solves a lot of bacterial issues. So we do, if we put more effort towards these big solutions, I think that we can succeed. But sometimes there aren't incremental economic incentives to these, like cure-alls, or they're difficult, they require a lot of work. So I think that scientists need to have an eye towards like bigger humanitarian objectives in their work, and that the academy needs to be more nurturing of longer-term projects that solve human challenges more definitively. And I think that Bill Gates and some other philanthropists have helped make that more acceptable, because they themselves, they have a lot of resources and they want to contribute to humanity as best they can. So that's encouraging. But also the dropping cost of gene synthesis is really concerning, since viruses and bacteria are some of the organisms with the shortest genetic code. So those will be the first things that can be manufactured in basements. And I'm not a biologist or anything like that either, but I've read articles about some of the research that was being done in the Soviet Union towards the end of the Soviet years, and it's scary stuff. You can take genes from different viruses, combine them together in the same virus, and get something that actually has the abilities of multiple viruses. So if you can combine those together in the right way, you'd probably be able to overcome a lot of human defenses. But again, just like the nuclear thing, it wouldn't probably wipe out all of humanity unless there were an agent that really wanted to kill everyone, because if there were a limited outbreak, maybe it would kill a few millions, or like a Spanish flu, it might kill as much as 100 million, a few hundred million in the worst-case scenario, but it wouldn't wipe out all of humanity.
Oh, Phil, what's the next the existential risk that we need to talk about?
The next item on our hit parade we may have covered already, due to the likely causes of it. But the next one we had on the list was ecological disaster. We can imagine that occurring through global warming. Climate change is the one that people are most concerned about. But in my day, we've also been very concerned about pollution. Nanotechnology potentially brings other possible pollution risks. So just ecological disaster in general, is it a showstopper or something that might slow us down, and what are the chances we're going to hit it? Brian, you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I don't see that one as a existential risk. It happens too slowly to kill everyone. It's currently happening now, and it kills millions, like air pollution, water pollution, those things kill millions, and that should be enough reason for us to change and do stuff about it. Using coal and other fossil fuels is bad, and we should do more about it. On the other hand, we are losing a lot of species, but we did that before when we went to farming, where we turned a lot of wild land and killed off species and made it more monoculture kind of farm or ranch situation, and that's happening in the ocean as well, where we're kind of going to fish farming. So there are certain things where we should do far, far better, and just the fact that it's not going to kill us, we should still do something about it. That's my general position on that.
Okay, fair enough. Michael, what do you think?
About the ecological damage.
Yeah, generally speaking, ecological disaster. Yeah.
Well, I agree with Brian. It's kind of a slow term thing, but I see us as like temporarily taxing the earth in the sense that we're burning up all the fossil fuels, and we're enforcing a lot of genetic lack of diversity. Like a field of wheat that stretches for many thousands of square miles is not very ecologically interesting. So although I don't think it's from an existential risk perspective a big issue, I think that in the longer term we need to encourage more, we need to shepherd the environment better, because for most of human history we've just said, like, screw the environment, we're going to do things for ourselves, and that's killed off a lot of species. I mean, the fifth major extinction in Earth's history has been caused by humanity. So it's the first time that it didn't, that required that something other than like a common impact or sustained volcanism has caused mass species death. So that's pretty concerning, and it's something we should do something about.
Absolutely, big concern there. What, Alvis? What do you think? Ecological disaster, is it on the radar as something that might totally wipe us out? Something that we need to just be concerned about, and what are the chances?
I think it's something we need to be very concerned about. I don't think it's something that can wipe us out. I think that it really depends on how many of how many species, how many life cycles, that distribute energy around the planet get disrupted, and to what extent. You know, it's very difficult to imagine a scenario that wipes all these different layers of life out, top to bottom. Otherwise, I think, if it doesn't happen, top to bottom to a deep enough extent, then it seems like humanity certainly is resilient enough to bounce back, mutate, adapt, and it's more likely to be something that doesn't even take us back to the Stone Age. It's, likely to take us back to like the 1800s or 1700s or something like that, like a Postman or a Mad Max kind of scenario is like kind of the likeliest thing I imagine there as a worst case scenario.
And that's pretty darn scary when you think about it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, let me just throw this out. I mean, there are lots of different ways that we can buy it, right? I mean, each of y'all, I'm sure, have probably thought of existential risk that we've not covered tonight, or maybe some combination. Let me just throw this back at y'all. What's a risk that we're failing to talk about tonight? Let's start with you, Michael.
Well, the number one risk that I think that we should be more attuned to is the solar flare or EMP risk that could screw up our power grid. And it wouldn't even cost us that much to shield the main transformers in our power grid from such an event. There's a possibility if the power grid got wiped out by a mega solar flare or EMP, more likely a mega solar flare, I think, would be the bigger challenge, is that everything depends on electricity to keep functioning, and the system has been built up in a really roughshod way over many decades. It's not very resilient. Much of it's based on old technology. So I think that we're getting to the point where we need to, I guess like in computer scientist language, kind of like pull apart the spaghetti code, rip it all down, start over with a better like societal infrastructure for the essential services that we need to survive and build in more resilience. And I see like the solar flare challenge as part of just the bigger challenge of our societal structure is fragile, and it hasn't been around long, and we haven't done enough to make it resilient. So I see that as something where risks that we don't quite, as it makes us more susceptible to all risks that we aren't resilient, and even unforeseen risks. So sometimes I think it's better to just make ourselves more resilient than enumerate all the possible risks, and that's just the main thing I wanted to touch on.
Okay. Well, Brian, what is a risk that we've failed to talk about tonight that's an important one?
The main risk that I'm concerned about is the fact that we're not progressing fast enough, that we have risks from new technologies and from AI and those kind of things, but I think that we have current problems, and because we can't convince anyone to really plan ahead or to be more competent and be more systematic and that kind of thing, and I don't see major success convincing people of that, then we might as well just push on ahead and go as fast as we can to get the better capabilities, make, you know, everyone richer and all that kind of stuff, and then hope that when things do emerge, that we can detect them fast enough and react to them as fast as we can. Because the foresight isn't happening much. There's only a few, small fraction of people that are concerned about that. So I think the best strategy is just push on ahead as fast as we can and to get people convinced of that. And I think that we're not pushing ahead as fast as we can, that we're choosing the wrong projects. I think it'd be easier to find ways to break through those things to get to better development.
Not moving fast enough. That's beautifully contrarian. I appreciate that, Brian. That's great. Alvis, what do you think? What's a risk that we have failed to touch on tonight?
You know, I think some of the biggest risks that we could possibly face as a species, exist in the areas outside of our current scientific understanding. There's a lot of theoretical cosmology out there, stuff like simulation hypothesis, where we may, the argument is that we may be in a chain of simulations of life that, continues to simulate itself. If that chain breaks somewhere, above us, or if somebody decides, a scientist looking down at a little universe computer decides to turn it off for some reason, I think that's a huge risk, although incredibly low probability from our current kind of framework of understanding. Or something like, like a developmental risk, like if we are, destined to enter like a singularity, developmental singularity and the black hole merger kind of situation, as, guys like John Smart have hypothesized, then maybe on the way in, as we reconcile all the different life in the universe, if that's the way it is, these are huge ifs, perhaps, the later that we get to the merger, like as Brian's saying, if we go too slow, from a much bigger, broader perspective, if we go too slow, then, maybe we become irrelevant and we just get, canceled out of the equation, as the more intelligent early movers take, better position.
All right, well, that's going to have to be the last word, because we have come to the end of the time that we have available this evening to talk about this, and that's going to have to do it for this edition of The World Transform 2. Gentlemen, I can't tell you what a pleasure it is talking with each of you, and I thank each of you for your unique perspective and contribution to this vital topic. Thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you, Phil. Yeah, and Steve. It's always awesome to be here. And thank you.
Well, we want to say thank you to our partner organizations for helping to make this show possible. The SINS Foundation, the Foresight Institute, Humanity Plus, and Singularity University. Last week we started a new thing where each one of our partners has sort of a segment in the show, and tonight it's the Foresight Institute. So here's a special message from the folks at Foresight.
We're very pleased and honored that the Foresight Institute is one of our partners in presenting The World Transformed to you. And I'm talking with Desiree Dudley. Desiree is the Director of Development and Outreach for Foresight Institute. Hello, Desiree.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me today.
Well, we're glad to have you. Well, why don't we start off by talking a little bit about what Foresight is and what the organization does.
Sure. So the Foresight Institute is a public think tank and interest organization focused on transformative technologies. We've been around since 1986, actually. The founders, the first books on nanotechnology in particular, although we are also very interested in AI, biotech, and other sorts of life-changing developments. Our mission is essentially to speed the development of nanotechnology and these technologies and promote the beneficial uses of these technologies, as well as reduce misuse and accidents potentially associated with them.
Okay, so both developing, bringing into existence, and protecting ourselves against transformative new technologies. Kind of a broad charter, but a real focus on nanotechnology, since that was how it started.
Yes, definitely.
So why would folks who've been listening to Fast Forward Radio, or in particular The World Transformed, why would they be interested in what Foresight does?
Well, I mean, if you all are interested in a better future, essentially, I mean, our main interest is advancing beneficial nanotechnology. And nanotechnology is basically something that's very, very tiny in scale but immense in possibilities. There are all sorts of applications in nanotechnology. Actually, just last month I was reading about the synthetic windpipe that was successfully implanted into a guy, and he's using it today. And that that windpipe wouldn't have been possible without advances in nanotechnology. And there are all sorts of advances like this that are actually happening every day that we try to keep tabs on and communicate and inspire new people with.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the series is called The World Transformed, and we listed nanotechnology as one of the technologies that truly is transforming our world. So I think you're absolutely right. Our listeners are well advised to learn more about Foresight. So where do they learn about Foresight, and if they're interested, how can they get involved?
Sure. So one of the easiest ways to get involved is actually just to go to our website, which is www.foresight.org. You can sign up on the mailing list on the very first page, and that will actually give you access to our weekly digest, which has some of the upcoming, you know, the latest and greatest in nanotechnology every couple of days or so. And we'll also tell you about all of our events. We have conferences, and we put out white papers, and we have dinner lectures and all sorts of things like that. So you guys should come check it out.
Absolutely. Could you say a word or two about the is it still called the Vision Weekend, the big Foresight get-together that I believe
you
just
had? We have had Vision Weekends. We have actually a variety of things that we put together. We have Vision Weekends, and we also put on technical conferences for people who are more oriented and specifically working in the field. Vision Weekends are exciting for members traditionally because they get together and they talk about all the possibilities in the future. And we've had a wide array of people attend these Vision Weekends over the years, including like Luke Nosek, who was a founder of PayPal, is now at the Funders Fund, and Eric Schmidt, I believe, has come as well. Steve Jurvetson, who's a big VC, has been there. Peter Voss, who's an AI researcher, came to our reunion conference that we just had at Google a month ago. So it's a really neat space for people to get together and talk about what's really happening on the edge of new technology. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, I have to give my own personal endorsement to the Foresight Vision Weekend. I've mentioned this on the program before, but I attended the Vision Weekend in 2003, and a lot of what I've done since then, including starting The Speculist and starting Fast Forward Radio and certainly this series, The World Transformed, is all really kind of a result of my going to that conference. So I can't recommend that event highly enough, and I can't recommend Foresight Institute highly enough to our listeners. Definitely do check it out. And thank you so much, Desiree, for talking with us about it today.
Great. No, thank you. That's so wonderful to hear. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks. You do the same. All right. Once again, if you're interested in finding out more about Foresight, check them out at foresight.org, or you can follow the links that we have on our partner page at worldtransformed.com. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and a special shout-out to all the participants in the chat room and our friends from the Singularity Network who've joined us this evening. And last but not least, a big thank you to Jean-Sébastien Bimius, the founder of the Singularity Network, for providing our theme music. Next week, The World Transformed 2 continues with Part 9, The Future Transformed. Join us as we welcome Ray Kurzweil, Anders Sandberg, and Philippe Van Netterveld talking about the technological singularity. Hope you'll be able to join us for that program. And until next time, live to see it.